Oh my goodness. How heavy is the question box tonight? Oh dear. Anyway, we shall see. Very good. No, not that bad. Okay, the very first question. As my meditation deepens. First ever. My? It's not your meditation. It doesn't belong to you. It comes and it goes. Anyway, I am noticing subtle ways I am controlling the meditation. Ah, yes. And grasping at the breath rather than letting it come to me. I have also noticed that doing this allows me to stay with the breath more easily and for longer. Is there an optimum balance between letting go and control? Yes, the optimum balance is full letting go and no control. That's the optimum. And then if the breath disappears, fine. What else are you watching? There's something left there, so whatever's right in front of you is the most important object. So that's what you watch. With no control, just with the kindness. That kindness, that caring, is the opposite of control. It's the opening the door of your heart to whatever's happening right now. With no criticism and no wanting this and not wanting that. It's the letting go of the craving, letting go of the wanting, second noble truth. So that means when you're caring for this moment, just letting it be. One thing you can always remember, it's not your meditation. It doesn't belong to you. It's just what happens. Not me, not mine, not a self. Then it gets very peaceful. Can you do that? Anyway, that was the answer. The optimum is letting go. Try more letting go. Less control. See what happens. Dear Ajahn, I seem to overcome drowsiness. Yay! I'm often able to sit for up to 2 hours. Yay! With pretty good focus on the in and out breath. Yay! There are times when the mind would wonder. Oh. But never too long. Yay! I would experience calm and a gradual softening of the breath. Yet. Yes, good. Now my most... the word I dislike the most. But. Can we just delete that from the English language? That seems to be it. You know they say, I think the US Marines used to say, kick butt. You know what that means, don't you, to kick butt? It's not, that's a bit violent thing, but I can understand where they're coming from. But that seems to be it. I can't experience the beauty of breath or joy or bliss. It's just relaxing. It's dark with no bright lights. How do I bring up the joy that you spoke about? One of the things which you can do is when you are meditating, it's getting nice and peaceful, but it's no kind of brightness or joy there or beautiful lights. Just put your attention just for 1 minute on your mouth. Turn the corners up. Smile when you're meditating. That's one of the most important parts of the posture for meditating. I don't care whether your right leg's over your left leg or left leg over your right leg or one leg this way and that way. I don't care if your body's really slumped over. I don't mind you got your right arm over your left arm or left arm over the right arm, and things touching or all over the place. You can put your hands on your head if you want. What's really important is you're smiling. if you can. And if you do get a smile on your face when you're meditating, or you even can't, you don't make one, you fake one, I don't care. You got that, and that makes the meditation more bright. And sometimes that's all you need. You meditate, it's nice and peaceful. A little smile on your face, and this joy. And you use that joy, it's like a match, a small light, and it lights a fire of happiness and joy. Try that. I told this story, I think, in Nolomara a few days ago. Stupid young man when I was at college, and they were, you know, I came from a poor home, fair enough. So when I went there, they held all these societies to join. I joined the ones I really wanted to, but I also joined a couple which I didn't want to. You know how they made me join those clubs? They were having these, what do you call it, like receptions with free sherry. And I know, in those days, I was only 18, I hadn't given up alcohol yet, so you had this free sherry, really nice stuff, as much as you wanted. And then they were telling you about the benefits of joining these clubs. And one of the clubs which I joined, I think I had too much sherry actually, was the cottage boat club, you know, when you went rowing down the river. Oh, crikey, why did I do that? The one thing I learned from that, which, you know, it was worth it, was that one day when you were in a race on one of these eights, you know, the eight students and the cox in the front, and we were rowing, and it's really, really hard work. It was in a race, and we had to really row hard. And then the coach on the towpath shouted out at me. My name at that time was Peter. Peter, you are making an ugly face. You can imagine, you're rowing this, it's really hard, you're running out of energy, and you wonder what you did to do, I have to do this. And then he said, smile. And at that time, I was willing to try anything. I was just so open to suggestions. And I smiled. That was a real smile. And one of the things which I noticed, you had more energy immediately. And it was easier to pull the oar. And that really quite stunned me. I didn't realize the power of the mind and even physical exercise. So please remember that. Those of you who are doing the duties in the kitchen, like, you know, washing the dishes or wiping them, smile when you're wiping them. The dishes become cleaner and you get more dishes done in less time. But it's also just the power of smiling no matter what you're doing. It makes the work much easier. You get things done with higher quality and it's more fun. So that's important also when you're meditating. It just allows the meditation to become more, become better and just more joyful. Why not? Dear Arjuna, if someone is having a serious chronic illness and if that person is meditating deeply, at what point or which stage he or she needs to address that? And how? Think about it and tell the mind to cure it or not. Thank you muchly. You don't address it. All you do is just leave it alone, because those chronic illnesses, you know, are in the body. So what you do is you just, all the body and the five senses which define it, so the five senses disappear. Once those five senses disappear, then you go into a nice, deep, beautiful meditation. When you come out afterwards, there's a lot of healing goes on. And I'm fascinated by that, because, like even Ajahn Chah, remember him telling me, because he was a Thai forest monk, there was always lots of malaria in the jungles. That was like monk's illness for most of the monks, getting malaria. And then he just used to always have, when his body was weak, the malaria would come up again and be in a fever and be very sick. But then one day he got fed up with having malaria, and so he decided he'll meditate. And what he told me, when he meditated, again, he'd go inside, and he went inside to the spot inside his body and his mind, and the malaria fever was just really just raging. And you know, his image at that time was he was in this forest. Where he was sitting was really cool. It was like a forest fire all around him, getting hotter and hotter and hotter. But where he was sitting in the middle, you know, there was no heat at all. It was really cool. But he could know that it was getting hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter, and then it exploded. And that was the end of his malaria fever. He never had it again. Fascinating. But that's the kind of thing which happens. I don't know how you could explain that through medicine, but there's always some really weird things which happen with medicine, which a lot of times people don't know about. Like this other time. This is a nice story. This was, you know, when there's lots and lots and lots of snakes over in Northeast Thailand, and you got used to them after a while. You know, I remember once I was doing some chanting, it was the Patimokkha chanting, and right in front of me there was one of the monks listening to it, and he had his hands up as we do this specific chant on the moon days. And then as I was chanting, I noticed a head pop up on his shoulder. It was a snake. The snake had crawled up his back, and then he noticed out of the corner of his eye there was a snake. He turned around, the snake turned around, and they were eyeballing each other. Neither of them know what to do next. You know, the snake never wanted to bite him, and he didn't want to bite the snake or anything. They're just looking at each other, what to do next. And so what he did with his robe, he just very gently just let it fall down, so the snake could actually gently fall down and crawl off. That's how it was with the snakes over there. You know, that they never seemed to bite anybody. But after I left, when I came to Australia, there was one Singaporean monk, and he got bit by a snake in Wat Nanachar. And what happened? He went to the library, and there was another monk in there, and he asked the other monk in there, "Do you know where the snake book is?" He said, "Yes, over here." And he gave him the snake book, and the Singapore monk was looking through the snake book, and then, "Oh dear, that's the one which just bit me, and it's deadly." And the other monk was, you know, obviously concerned, and he saw the wound, the two bite marks, it was all going red and expand, and what was it called?
Swelling
up, yeah. And so that is one of the occasions when a monk is allowed to run to get help. Because, you know, seconds count. So he ran into the village to get a doctor. And the doctor came on the motorbike, but it wasn't an ordinary doctor. It was one of these villagers who had learned a special chant to cure snake bites. And so the Singaporean monk, highly educated, sort of, you know, was waiting for a proper doctor, and this guy came in from the village, and he chewed some herbs in his mouth, spat it on the wound, and did a chant, chewed some more herbs and spat it on the wound. Now imagine that was you. The Singaporean monk said, "Please, can I have a proper doctor?" "Here's a real snake bite. You can see the two puncture wounds and they're red and it was just really swelling up big." And he was scared. "Can I have a proper doctor?" But no, they just carried on doing the spitting and the chanting. And I heard about this from the local villagers, you know, before I left Wat Nanachar. I know I was fluent in Isan language of those days. And they were friends. And so they said, "Yeah, it's really weird. They'd given away all their anti-venom, you know, which they had in the the medical, not really facility, but just the person who looked after that in the village. They'd given it all away because they didn't need it anymore. Any villager who got bitten by a snake would get this guy out and he'd do his hocus pocus, but it would always heal up. And these monks, when they saw this, they saw with their own eyes just, you know, the swelling go down, the redness disappear, and those two puncture wounds just close up in front of their eyes. It was like almost like magic, but it was real. And that's, you know, some of those things which you think, my goodness, what's actually happening? There's more, you know, that happens in this world. And this Singaporean monk, he didn't believe anything. Given the opportunity, he would have called an ambulance and gone to the hospital and just had injection after injection or whatever. But anyway, this worked. And he was fine. So there are some things where, you know, that people get healed for the most amazing ways. So anyway, if you have got, or at least a chronic illness somewhere, don't even try to heal it. Just make peace, go inside of it, and sometimes it just vanishes. Disappears totally. You know, like that guy who had the tumour in his nose. He had a popping sound. He was just relaxing to the max. He could breathe for a little while. And then it closed up, but then he carried on and it opened up totally later on. Some of the things which happen are weird. Well, there's another Malaysian guy in Penang. Because, you know, he, you know, told me that he had a very weird disease of his brain, like some of the neural passages were all entangled or something. There was only one place they could treat it. It was in Singapore. Very expensive and actually very painful to have this operation. Couldn't have any anaesthetic. And he didn't know whether to really take it the first time or just let himself die, but he just got married. So he thought it's not really fair for his wife if he just dies like this. So they had the operation, they fixed it up. Everything was going well. And then, for a weird reason, it returned again. He had it again. And so, you know, he was really concerned. He came up to see me in Penang. So, is there any other way of dealing with this? And I said, yeah, meditation. Give it a try. I've got nothing to lose. So I taught him how to meditate. And then he still had to have the operation because his wife had just had a kid. And he thought, no, I've got a kid now. Two things to worry about. So he went down to Singapore for the operation. They had to, I think, shave his hair and put this frame on his head before they were going to cut him open. And they gave him another CT scan. And as soon as he was ready for the operation, they said, there's something wrong with the CT or the CT scan. We have to do it again. And I tell everybody, if ever that happens to you, they do a CT scan, it's not working, there's something wrong. Yes! Because they did a second CT scan and they said, you don't need the operation. Don't know why, but it's all healed up. And he was so happy. He made a special trip to come and see me to say thank you. These things sometimes happen. It's weird. Anyway, so if you have some serious chronic illness or some sort of terminal disease, especially cancers and stuff, sometimes it's weird. You get into some nice meditation and it fixes it up. I don't know how it happens, but I've seen it happen too often. Anyway, this is not a meditation question, but a friend is in trouble. Her teenage son is hot-tempered, difficult, etc. The mother shares merits with him after her evening chanting, but it doesn't work. Please help. Teenage son. A lot of times teenage sons are hot-tempered. I remember this story of this gentleman. He's only a villager, and he had a business of transporting salt and selling it, you know, in the countryside. And he had a teenage son who helped him, but his teenage son would never follow orders. So the father you know, the owner of the business, when they were transporting salt with donkeys, if the donkey was crossing a bridge and leaning to the left and in danger of falling in, the father would tell his son, push it to the left. And the son would always push it to the right. Because whatever the son said, he would do the opposite. And if it was leaning to the right, push it more to the right. And the son would push it to the left. That way of balance. And one day they were taking the donkeys on this business selling thing. And then the donkey was leaning to the left. And the father said, it's leaning to the left, push it more to the left. And the son pushed it to the left and it fell in, they lost all the salt. And the father said, what do you do that for? Dad, don't you know today was my 20th birthday? I'm not a teenager anymore. And that story, it's funny, you can say it's a joke, but that story was one of those tales of Nasruddin that was in Iran about 800 years ago. Teenagers do not change. You just have to know how to deal with them. 800 years, Islamic tradition, Iran. And they still, well, Sufi tradition, still that's what teenagers were like. So wait till he turns 20 and then he won't be a problem. Dear Ajahn, why is it not easy to shut down five senses? I relax to the max, but the hearing and body sensation are still there. It's because, you know, you're concerned about them. After a while, the hearing. There's no one saying anything important here. Except maybe. What are you hearing? The sound of the rain? Is that important? And so a lot of time, why are you listening? There's a difference between hearing and listening. Listening when you go out to the sound and want to try and understand it and do something with it. The hearing is just noise, that's all. Just the sound of, you know, an aircraft in the distance. You hear it, but you don't listen to it. So anyway, once you can just hear but not listen, then after a while, you know, you can't sort of hear anything at all. It's not important to you. It vanishes. The brain actually can't experience anything. You cannot be mindful of everything happening. That's an impossibility. So the brain actually chooses what is more important. And that's what it pays attention to. And if you realize that all these sounds are not important, you know, sometimes you hear people talking and you want to sort of listen, what are they talking about? You know why? Because you always think they're talking about you. Or they may be. They're not. So you can just forget about it and just not listen at all. And then the hearing goes. Number two is, again, the feeling in the body. That it needs to relax to the max. You can get rid of the feeling in the body. You know, sometimes, again, when you're watching a movie or a football match or a cricket match, then when it finishes, oh, I really need to go to the toilet. You wanted to go to the toilet a long time ago. You didn't feel it because you're busy, you know, looking at the movie. You've noticed that. So sometimes it's the case that we feel these things. Why? Sometimes it's because we've got nothing else to do. We're not really appreciating the silence. Then we go like searching. It's like in the old days, what do they used to call it when you went through all the different channels on the TV? Surfing, channel surfing. I didn't have a TV as a monk, so this is what people tell me. You've got nothing to do. What's on the TV? And you surf this. Or you go into the fridge, what's there in the fridge to eat? And there's food falling out of the fridge. Oh, there's nothing in the fridge. In other words, you're looking for these things because you are bored. and it's just, you know, something to distract yourself. But if, you know, you can be experiencing, say, the delightful breath, that is so lovely that you don't need to distract yourself. It's, you know, even better than watching Sri Lanka beat Australia in the cricket. Did I say the wrong thing there for a few Australians? But you know what I'm talking about. You're enjoying it, so it really sort of gets you involved. I know all about that because sometimes years ago I went to Adelaide to give a talk, and it was at the Sri Lankan temple. Hardly anyone turned up. There was a big cricket match, a one day international Sri Lanka versus Australia. You should have arranged it a different day. So when it was the moon day, that doesn't matter when it comes to cricket. Anyway. After a while you learn how to shut down the senses, and it's not a big deal. In the book, The Art of Disappearing, oh, I love that book. You mention, can't I love my own books? Is there something evil about that or something? It is, it's a very good Dhamma in there. You mentioned we need to develop nibbida towards the world. You say it's different from just accepting the world. Can you kindly explain how nibbida is different from just acceptance? Yeah. It's, you know, sometimes, why am I getting involved in this world? You know, it's just, it's a burden. You do get some negativity towards these things. But not negativity which makes you tense or, but it's just, what am I doing that for? If you had a big disease and you managed to overcome it and you're free from that disease, would you just accept the possibility of that disease again, or you just try and make sure it doesn't happen again? You have like nibbida towards cancer if you've had it once. If you managed to put your foot in a dog poo, you wouldn't like go looking for dog poo again. You get nibbida towards it. The sense of, what do I do that for? Much of the things in life we do have nibbida towards, if we're wise. When you retire from work, you got enough saved up to look after yourself, would you want to go back to work again? You have nibbida towards it. It's enough for now. So that nibbida is just, what am I getting involved in this again for? You know, you go to the toilets and you wipe your backside and you get some brown stuff on your fingers you weren't careful enough. What do? Would you just accept the little bit of feces on your fingers? Just accept it, be at peace with it, let it be. I hope not. Especially you offering me a tea during the interviews. You have nibbida towards it. And that's the type of nibbida. It's just to be free of these things. I often say that one of the similes I use is on the wheel of samsara. I always sometimes looked at it like a Ferris wheel going up and down, round, round and round. And just by saying, oh, just let it be, have acceptance, don't do anything. I said that word very carefully. Then you won't get stuck on the wheel, but you won't get off either. You'll just be sitting there. You have a sense of nibbida. I call nibbida the ejection seat of samsara. It pushes you off it. You got nibbida? You've got nibbida to something. Something, you know, hard time, you got rid of that, and so you don't really want it back again. It's sometimes hard to describe to people, but it's true, that nibbida is a positive negativity. It's a negativity which pushes you away from unfortunate situations. I had this question the last time somewhere. Oh, in Hong Kong. How is intuition related to knowing? Is it genuine knowing of the mind where we let go of logic and reasoning? How is it related to feelings and emotions? The intuition, that is, it is logic, it is reasoning, but it's much more complicated reasoning and logic. Sometimes logic, you know, what is the cause of something? It's sometimes many causes, and they're all sort of interrelated, they're not sequential. Life is not simple. So sometimes you have all this experience and you have to make a decision. One of the best ways of making decisions is you put all of the logic, all of the knowing into, you know, your computer and just let it sort of process. And after a while, it appears like a feeling or like an intuition. Yeah, this is, I think, what's right. And this whole story again, that when I was in Oslo University many years ago, and somebody asked a question, they've got a difficult decision to make in life, how can I make that decision? And the whole story was that I looked at this young lady, and she was sitting next to a boy, they're obviously having an affair together or close together. So I said, well, look, let's make it a more easy question to answer. Suppose your question was, you know, should I accept my boyfriend's marriage proposal? Should I or should I not? It's an important decision because that will be just for your life. And this poor woman, I shouldn't have said that because she put her head under and she went bright red. I nailed her the first time. That's the thing she was worrying about. And I said, look, if it's something as important as should you accept that marriage proposal or not, what to do is get out a coin, toss it up, heads I marry him, tails I don't. It's only a marriage. But of course, you know, it's more profound than that, this answer. If it comes up heads I marry him, how do you feel? If you feel, let's try 2 out of 3. That is revealing what your intuition is. You don't want to marry him. And if you toss it up, heads, it comes up heads, I marry him, you think, yes. Then that shows your intuition was to marry him. And all the time, your intuition is never perfectly accurate, but it is more reliable than your logic and reason. It doesn't go against a logic or reason, but it builds on these complicated questions which need more than logic and reason to find good answers. So that's how intuition is related to knowing. You know, many times, especially, you know, in that field I studied, you know, theoretical physics, science, some of those great discoveries, you know, were illogical. You know, you had to, you know, when you, what was it when that famous argument between Niels Bohr and Albert Einstein about quantum theory? And Albert Einstein, with all his great intellect, he just could not understand quantum theory. And his response was like, God doesn't play dice. You know, he was an atheist. And Niels Bohr was right. But it just went further than logic and reason could take you. Here we go. It's one of the favourite stories from quantum physics, Schrödinger's cat. If you haven't heard that before, it's a great sort of story. Erwin Schrödinger. But anyway, he devised what he called thought experiment. You get a box, you put a cat in the box, a healthy cat, you close the box, and in that box there's a cyanide capsule. And it will break if a cesium atom decays, and it's got 50-50 chance of decaying. And the thing is, unless you open the box, you don't know if that cesium atom has decayed and the capsule of cyanide is broken and the cat dies. You don't know until you open the box. And after a certain time, 50-50 chance the cat is dead, 50% it could be alive. But according to quantum theory, and this has been proved many times, the cat is neither alive nor dead. It's in a third state, a quantum probability state. And when you open that box, only then do those two probabilities, one of them collapses and the other one is. And that's how many things like quantum computers work. There's so much stuff in our world which is quantum based like that. It doesn't make any sense. You know, the cat is alive or dead. You only find out which one it is until you open the box. No, when you open the box, that's what makes a cat alive or dead. It's neither beforehand. I don't know if I explained that clearly enough, but that is the truth of it, Schrodinger's cat. Is that logical? But it's true. And things like that, well, that's actually what I gained from doing science. It was my reason, my logic, was not developed enough. That is highly logical. But it takes the logic to a very deeper state. Other little things, a good example, more simple. Old Einstein used to say you can't travel faster than the speed of light. You can't. But, say Alpha Centauri, our nearest star, I think it's, I don't know how many light years away, maybe 5 light years away. So, you can't go faster than light, but you can get to Alpha Centauri 5 light years away in 5 minutes. If you can survive the acceleration of propulsion. You get there in 5 minutes, but it's 5 light years away. How can that happen? And what happens is that when you get there and you turn around and come straight back, it's only a 10-minute journey, you can actually do it and I probably won't know you're missing. Would I? For me, 10 years have gone past. For you, it feels like only 10 minutes. And if you had a clock on your wrist, it would be 5 minutes there, 5 minutes back. But over here, 10 years would have passed. Is that reasonable, logical? That's been proven many times. So this is why I love science, because it bamboozles you. It takes you and you realize the limitations of logic. And sometimes that's one of the reasons why intuition is great. Because that can extend the reach of logic. It doesn't go against logic. It doesn't go against reason. It just takes it further. That's why I love this sort of stuff. And that's the same with diseases which suddenly vanish. Or that monk I said with rays of light coming out of his eyes. That's impossible. That happened. Okay, next one. Dear Ajahn Brahm, in the Metta Sutta, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desire, is not born again into this world. Actually, that's not what it says. It says, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, having freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Okay. I wanted to do something a bit funny after talking about quantum physics. How do you relate this to Vajrayana meditation of reincarnate monks? Yeah, some monks can reincarnate, but basically the wise one will get out of this world. You know, sometimes this is an argument which sometimes out of feelings of not wanting to offend people, you don't really make enough. The way it works, the Buddha, and he became fully enlightened. And after 45 years of teachings, he vanished, he disappeared. He parinibbana, never to return again. He didn't suddenly, you know, go somewhere to the Buddha's holiday camp to live happily ever after. You know, he vanished. Where did the Buddha go? And the answer taught by the Buddha was, you know, when he was still alive, was in suttas by the Agni Vajragota Sutta. I will adapt it. I'm not saying it exactly as it is in that sutta, but I'm not messing around with it to fit my ideas. It's like a candle, a lit candle. The flame of that candle depends upon three things: the wick, the wax, and the heat. Those three things come together, you get a flame. And if any one of those three things runs out, ceases, stops, there's no more wax left in the candle, or the wick is all burnt out, or someone blows the heat away, then there's no more candle. Where does the candle go? Does the candle go to the happy land where good candles who have always, you know, never burnt anybody and has always never flickered when you really want to see something? Where all good candles go to flame happily ever after? And all the bad candles go down to hell where they go burning people? What happens to candles? It's a silly question. The candle's gone out. It's nibbanaed. And that's the word they used in the time of the Buddha. When a candle went out, it nibbanaed. In one of the suttas we often chant, in the Ratana Sutta, Nibbanti Dira Yatayang Padipo. Padipo was the oil lamp. It's going to go out. Nibbanti, it's a verb, it's going to nibbana, just like this flame of an oil lamp. So in the time of the Buddha, the kid would come running to you, "Mummy, mummy, mummy, the candle's nibbanaed." It didn't mean it got enlightened, it meant it got de-enlightened. In other words, it went out. And that was what it meant. So anyway, but then, who's going to teach us afterwards when the Buddha disappears? How many people have been teaching you for the last 2,500 years? There have been so many enlightened monks and nuns, and they've been teaching us all this time. So what happens? You've got a great, say, doctor, and he dies. Who's going to be able to do the operations from now on? That doctor has taught so many other doctors, and many of those doctors have become as good and as skillful as that first doctor. They're the ones who treat us. And then they pass away, but before they pass away, they train many others. So that is actually, that is how the wheel of Dhamma is always pushed, not by the same person all the time, but we all have a turn pushing it, keeping it mobile. And then an enlightened being arises and pushes that Dhamma wheel, passes away, then another enlightened being passes away. There's always somebody pushing that wheel. Does that make sense? Okay. It makes sense or not? I don't know. Dear Ajahn Brahm, collection of the Sangha. Hey? Oh, someone's been listening to the chanting. Yadi dang chatari purusa yugani atta purusa pugla. That is the four persons, the eight kinds of noble beings. Where are the eight kinds of noble beings? Thank you. The eight. I think this is one of the reasons why in the Chinese tradition, eight is the magic number. Is that correct? So the four types of beings, the eight pairs, is the one who is on the path to being a stream winner, one who's attained stream winning, that's the first stage of enlightenment, one who's on the path to being a once returner, once who's attained to once returning, one who's on the path to being a non-returner, one who's attained non-returning, one who's on the path to being an arahat, and one who has attained full enlightenment. So those are the eight pairs. The ones who are sure of enlightenment. That makes any sense? Does that actually help you?
Yes,
okay. I think for a lot of people it's just theory. Anyway, when doing breath meditation, you are, of course, to first focus on the in and out breath, on in to out breath, focus on the entire breath from beginning to end. Is that the full breath from nostrils to lungs? No, you don't have to know where it goes to, where it comes from. Because sometimes it doesn't even go down to the lungs, it's, you can just feel it in the nostrils, so it just passes by. The full breath is to knowing every part of the breath cycle. So you know it at the very beginning of an in-breath, the next layer what did I say last time? It's much better to, as a finger passes, you see all of the movement of the finger. That's the full awareness of the finger moving. This is not full awareness. You miss a few stages. So the full awareness. Hopefully that explains it. Thank you very much for everything you do, and thank you for all in the Jhana Grove family. Much appreciated. We haven't finished yet. We've got a few more days to go. You've just been to the easy part. No, much appreciated, thank you. It's nice you actually called it Jhana Grove family, because after a few days that's what it feels like. These are your friends. You may not speak to one another, but please always smile at one another. Dear Ajahn, usually if I were to have vision during meditation, they are usually all grey in colour. Goodness. By this time, my vision of moving 3D objects, which I've never seen before, have colours. Oh, you've got colour vision. Amazing. One vision. That's an upgrade. When I was a kid, all the TVs are all black and white, all grey. So you're obviously upgrading. But this time, listen, Paul, I have colours. One vision has bluish background, the other one with yellowish background. One has reddish background with a strange red square at top, but others have 3D objects and are greyish. Apparently they do have 3D televisions. You have to put something on your eyes and you can sit in 3D, I don't know. So you're really up to date. Sorry. Are these related to complex nimittas or just Mara poking fun with my imagination during meditation? No, they're real. It is the way your perception is working. It's getting much more refined and much more bright and beautiful. So hopefully those colours get more intense. And as I said earlier, that sometimes if it's like a red colour, it's like a red you can never see in the real world. It's more red than red. Is there any way you can describe it? Dear Ajahn, during last evening's Q&A session, you had answered a question pertaining to be a nun or to live a layman's life. Actually, you can't, that's not a choice, is it, to be a nun or a layman? Be a nun or a laywoman's life. To be a monk or a layman. Anyway, but with opportunities to learn from different teachers. May I know what was the main purpose the Buddha gave ordination? Is it to help sentient beings end their suffering? Yes. Or to prolong the Buddha's sasana? Both. That's why the Buddha started the Sangha, the monastic Sangha and the nun Sangha. And I keep on saying this, but under the Bodhi tree, was under the Bodhi tree or just a little while later, Mara came to see the Buddha and said, "Congratulations, you know, I admit it, you know, you are now a fully enlightened person. But please, don't teach. If you have to teach others, it's always very tiring." I understand that now. And I have fun. So, teaching is tiring. So just, you know, enter parinibbana and just don't teach anything. And the Buddha said, no. He said, "I will not enter parinibbana until I have established a strong community of enlightened monks, a strong community of enlightened bhikkhunis, strong community of enlightened laymen and laywomen." He called those the four groups, Jhatara Parisa. And that was from the very beginning. It was like in his mission in life was to create a bhikkhuni sangha as well as a bhikkhu sangha and laymen and laywomen who were devoted Dhamma practitioners. And then many years later, under the, was it Chapala Shrine where Sali, Mara came to see him again when he was almost 80 and said to the Buddha, "You know, congratulations, that promise you made 45 years earlier, you've achieved. There's lots and lots of enlightened monks, enlightened nuns, great laymen and great laywomen, meditators. Your promise has been fulfilled. Now is the time for you to enter parinibbana." And the Buddha said, "Yes." He said, "In 3 months' time, I will enter parinibbana." I love that story because it shows what the Buddha's reason for teaching, why he wanted to make sure that these four communities interacting, supporting one another, was really important to him. And once that had been achieved, then he could go. And he realized that those were very strong communities helping each other. One of those communities might die down in one country. I remember just going over into Kandy and being shown, one of the first, it was only a novice at the time, I forget what his name was now, who resurrected Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism in Sri Lanka. What was his name? Okay. But anyway, he was a very devout, and he wrote down the Visuddhimagga by hand, because they didn't have any printing presses to print it, then no one would do that. And the Dutch, good on the Dutch, they were looking after Sri Lanka then, and they sent 3 ships over to Thailand to get a Sangha to come into Sri Lanka to restart the ordination. They'd lost, and there's no monks, Buddhist monks, in Sri Lanka at that time. And I think the first 2 ships, they sank. They never made it. The 3rd ship managed to bring some monks from Thailand, and they restarted the Sangha in Thailand, in Sri Lanka. And that's why the biggest group of monks in Sri Lanka is called the Siam Nikaya, because it came from Siam, Thailand at the time. And that's actually, it's always been happening like that. Even the Bhikkhuni Sangha, that was resurrected, because there was no Bhikkhunis for a while in places like Sri Lanka or Thailand or Myanmar. That was came from the Chinese, especially from Taiwan. And there's records that the Bhikkhunis from Sri Lanka went over to China and Taiwan, you know, to start monasteries over there many centuries ago. they changed the robes to more grey rather than dark brown, but they still have kept the ordination procedure according to the Vinaya. So they are legitimate bhikkhunis. They call themselves bhikkhunis, the Sanskrit form of the word. But they're the ones who could be used to resurrect the bhikkhuni sangha in Sri Lanka, Australia, and other countries in the world. That's how it's always worked. It never really runs out. Okay, anyway. How does the teaching of impermanence fit in with this meditation training? Impermanence, anicca, even that is not an accurate full translation of the word. Anicca, they have in the Vinaya, they have something called nicca food, nicca butter. Nicca butter is, I know tomorrow there's one Thai lady who's going to bring food to Bodhinyana to monastery, Sam. She's been doing that for about 30 years. You know, if she misses a Tuesday lunch offering, she must be really sick, or maybe visiting family overseas. But she'll be there tomorrow. Every Tuesday she comes. You know, rain or shine, rain's retreat or other times of the year, always there on Tuesday. We call that regular supply of food, nicca. The opposite of nicca, anicca, is irregular, uncertain. Something there has now vanished. I'm going to say something about that tomorrow, about I'm losing my pace here. With the meditation training you're doing here, I'll say it now, it's a simile which I've given many times here of the tadpole and the frog. The tadpole and the frog simile is explaining just how this type of meditation gives you insights, big insights. Tadpole, born in the water, lived all its life in the water. Doesn't matter how intelligent that tadpole is, can never understand what water is. No more than a fish can understand what water is. It's always been there, you can't even notice it. But the tadpole is different than the fish because one day the tadpole grows legs and arms, becomes a frog. And one day that frog jumps out of the lake. And it's a very weird experience. Something is missing, which has always been there. Always been there. Water. Now the frog has a chance to have insight into what water really is. The other fish can never know that. Once you jump out of the five sense world, when you grow these legs and arms to get you into a jhana, then this is a totally different experience. In that jhanas is something missing which has always been there. Now you know what that was. That's experiential. That's how the insight which shocks you and makes you enlightened comes around. I'll say more about that tomorrow. What about labelling thoughts at the beginning of meditation and in daily life? You can do that, but there is some negativity, there is some downside of labelling. This is that story of that wealthy lady who, she came to monastery just for a talk one evening, and she had to tell, she's wealthy, so she had a gatekeeper on her compound. So gatekeeper, look, there's burglars around. So make sure you don't let any burglars in while I'm at the temple. Be mindful. She said, madam, I am very mindful. I go to meditation retreats. I know what mindfulness is. You don't have anything to worry about. So off she went to listen to a talk. When she got back, her house had been robbed, ransacked. And she was very upset at the guard. I told you to be mindful. Madam, I was mindful. Well, the house has been robbed. How can you say you've been mindful? Madam, I saw a burglar going in. I noted burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I noticed jewelry going out, jewelry going out, jewelry going out, jewelry going out. I saw the truck going in, truck going in, truck going in, truck going in. I saw the safe going out, safe going out. I was mindful all the time, madam. Now, that's a bit naughty of me to... That's not actually how people do labelling, but that's one of its problems. It's not just labelling. If you're aware of something, snake, 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 snake. Biting, biting, biting. That means you're really dumb. If you're snake, 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 the kindness there as well. Make sure you get up and go away and don't get bitten by the snake. What about labelling? Oh yeah, the labelling thoughts. You can do that at the beginning of the meditation, but don't do it too much, because a lot of times you don't really know what that thought was. You give it a label and think that's what it is. Who am I? Am I really Ajahn Brahm? You can label me, but there's much more to me than that. Who are you? Does your name sort of describe what you are? So labels can be approximations. They're not really the full thing. Dear Ajahn, and all present, thank you for the energy that everyone has brought in letting go, does the issue to cease to exist, or does it not bother you anymore? How do you know if you're truly let go? In letting go, does the issue to cease to exist. The issue to cease to exist, obviously, when you know there's no one there anyway, you didn't exist in the first place, so nothing gets lost, of course that doesn't bother you. That's one of the things, that the idea of enlightenment is not an annihilation of something. What was the flame anyway? It was just three things coming together, the wick, the wax and the heat. Nothing got destroyed, only the causes ended, and with the causes ended, the result ended. Who are you? This is one of the biggest insights, and if you really want to know the answer to that one, everything will be revealed tomorrow morning, in tomorrow morning's talk, in a theatre closing. Mindful eating. Mindful eating porridge with nuts and a toothache. That must mean you didn't mindfully eat. If you've got a toothache, can't you eat something else? You don't have to crunch. Can you talk about feeling limiters? Okay, it's a good question. This is limiters which you perceive not through the sight like a light, but you perceive it with beautiful, pleasurable feelings. They are more difficult to be certain of and more difficult to develop, because the feelings of like pleasure, it's very hard to understand them, and sometimes you get very afraid of them. So the lights, we live much more in the realm of sight than we do in the realm of physical feelings, physical sensations. And so because of that, the light limiters are usually the better ones to experience. But sometimes people hear sound limiters. I don't know if you've ever heard this, but sometimes, you're sitting here and it's like you hear this heavenly chanting. Not like my chanting, which is definitely not heavenly. But it's really incredibly beautiful. Maybe it's got no sounds, no words to it, but it's beautiful. It just comes from nowhere, and there it is, and it's so delightful. And you're not hearing that. No one is making any noise or playing any music on their smartphones. But that's actually sometimes how you experience it, a sound limiter. But that is also much more difficult to make use of. It's one of the reasons why the light limiters are always the best, because we're more skilled in making use of those. Make sense? Ajahn Brahm, when people not... Hey? Please try and write clearly. When people... ask. When people ask you, aren't you afraid you might die taking the plane? Or aren't you afraid of death and dying? They're actually thinking about themselves in regard to you. Yes, selfish. That's why I sometimes say to people, when have a good day, and to the monks I never actually say that, have a good day if you want, but you don't have to. I'm not trying to control you when I say may you be happy today. When you say may all sentient beings be happy and well, what if sentient beings don't want to be happy and well? I think they have a choice. They can be grumpy if they want to. They've got my permission to be grumpy. You don't always have to be smiling when you see me. You can get miserable. So don't feel that you're a lesser being because, you know, that you're miserable and you can't be happy. And that was one of the reasons why. There's one of the ladies who came here. She doesn't mind me saying her name. That was Veronica, Ronnie. She came on one of these retreats and she came on her interview and she said, I just want to leave. So why? He said, well, look, I'm really miserable. The meditation's not working. It's really hopeless. And I saw all these other people smiling and happy. And that really messes me up. That makes me feel more miserable when I see all these happy people and I'm miserable. And so I told her, just wait for a few moments. And just next to where we do the interviews, there's one of the offices there. And I went in the office, opened up the computer, and I printed out this certificate. It was on letterhead paper, and it was in Gothic script. It looked really nice. And this certificate grants to Veronica permission to be grumpy for any reason or no reason at all, at any time, for however long she requires, and this permission should not be infringed until the coming of Maitreya the Buddha, signed Ajahn Brahm, teacher at Jhana Grove. And I gave it to her, the first grumpy certificate. And as soon as she got that grumpy certificate, she burst out laughing and she didn't need it anymore. It's almost like, you know, we're not allowed to feel what we are feeling. And that's what makes us grumpy. So it's nice that, you know, people, they're not actually thinking about themselves. They also care about other people as well. They care about me. And so it's nice. But nevertheless, they finish off this little question here. E.g., oh my God, oh my Buddha, what would I do without Ajahn Brahm? You don't know. You'll have no jokes. You'll have no scary ghost stories. I mean, somebody said today, please, sort of, don't tell the coffin joke. The coffin joke is so bad it should be buried. They made another joke, which is really nice. Do you want to hear the coffin joke? I've got a couple more questions, so I'll finish those questions and we'll, if you really want to, we can do the coffin joke. So I hope you'll live a long, long life for everyone's sake. A long life. How long is long? So my 72nd year, that's long enough. Regarding the worm story, how I use in meditation. Whenever I'm thinking, I say to myself, I'm in a pile of cow dung. Ajahn Brahm is brainwashing to get us out, but again, we creep into the cow dung. Well, if you like it, it's not up to me. I always think, may you be happy and well. How you want to be happy and well is your business. Okay, anyway, yes, fair enough. Can you please explain more about Dhammavitakka that happens in meditation and how to overcome it? You mentioned that it's Mara's last trap. Does it occur just before enlightenment? Basically, yes, just before samadhi, which gives rise to enlightenment, the samadhi of the jhanas. You know, you have a mind and it's mostly free of hindrances and you can think anything. You've got the power of mind, but you haven't got the data yet. The data which is totally different. The mind is powerful and it can just make some great sort of connections between different parts of the Dhamma, but it's very intellectual. You need something which you see, something you've never seen before. You know, such as, you know, your will vanishing, such as your body totally vanishing, such as the mind vanishing. That shouldn't happen, but it does, and you see it. And that makes you see things in a totally different way. That's insight which gets you enlightened. Anyway, my mental energy seems still high towards bedtime, midnight. In order to force myself to sleep, I keep having stray thoughts and end up sleeping quite late with weird dreams. Any recommended solutions? Yeah, it's easy. Sometimes I open my eyes early when I'm doing the meditation from 7 to 7:50. See a lot of people sleeping. So if you want to sleep, go to your room. Don't try and sleep. Try to meditate. And then you go fast asleep. A lot of time it's because we try to go to sleep. And that tenses up our mind. If you just lay down and just don't have any wishes in the whole world, whatever happens, I'm awake, I go to sleep, it's all the same to me. You know that for many years, you know, I would always be meditating a lot. And so when you went to lay down in your bed, that was so comfortable laying down. And a nice pillow under my head, you were tucked in, it was really cozy. And for a time, if I ever had any trouble not falling asleep, I would contemplate, what do I want to fall asleep for? This is the most comfortable position all day. In my cave, lying on the mattress and the pillow under my head, no one asks me any questions, I don't have to give any talks. I can just sit down and really relax in the most comfortable position during my day. I don't want to go to sleep. And as soon as I thought that I don't want to go to sleep, I fell fast asleep. The old reverse psychology trick. When you want to go to sleep, it's hard to. When you don't mind, either way, it's easy to go to sleep because you're relaxed. So if I just was rushing through those because I want to get to the coffee. Dear Ajahn Brahm, is smoking cigars, cigarettes or vaping including the fifth precepts? Actually, it's not. Because in the old days, many great monks would actually smoke cigarettes. And still, like in Burma, big cheroots. But nevertheless, it's not a sensible thing to do. Just because it's not in the five precepts, it doesn't mean it's allowed. So a sensible person would realize that kind of kills you. It's not just smoking cigars and cigarettes or vaping, it's also incense. I remember reading an article that inhaling the smoke from incense is really bad for your health. And that's one of the reasons why we don't have incense here. And it's also why in Nolamara, if I do have to light incense, I usually just keep it to one stick of incense rather than three. But sometimes I've seen in some temples they have a whole handful of incense and they put it in, and there's so much smoke comes out. That was helpful in places like Southeast Asia because it would kill all the mosquitoes, or at least drive them out. I didn't mind that, not having any mosquitoes in there. But other than that, why do they do that? You don't get more merit by giving all the monks lung cancer. So no need to do that. What about gambling? Buddha did not mention this in his precepts. Indeed. But someone once told me this story this morning that, they have gambling hotlines, you can get counselling, for problem gamblers. But not many people actually dial in. And they said it would work much better if you have a counselling hotline, if you'd say that every third caller will win a prize. Every third caller is a winner. It's obvious, most people know that if you gamble, you don't win anything. And you get really stupid things happen. There was one Thai abbot some years ago. And he was only in a medium-sized temple. And then one day he wasn't in his room anymore. And they wondered what happened. They quickly did a check. And he used to gamble. He'd take the money from the donation box and gamble on the Premier League football. It was hopeless. And he ran out of money. And then he ran out of the temple. So it's a stupid thing to do. And sometimes, because we always think that with gambling, that we can somehow find out who's going to win the race. And I think I did tell you the story of the five angels, didn't I? Did I tell you that story already on this retreat? Okay. This was here in Perth. This man, he had a dream. And the dream was five angels, five heavenly beings, had five big pots of gold each. And they lined up to offer this man 25 pots of gold, worth a fortune. And when he received the last pot of gold, that's when he woke up. And he was very disappointed because there was no angels in the room. Didn't mind that so much, but there was no pots of gold either. That was a bit disappointing. So then he went down. Sure, I didn't tell this the first day. Okay. I told it somewhere recently. But anyway, then he went down for breakfast. His wife had gone out to work early. So his wife had left him five pieces of toast and five boiled eggs. And this number five was almost like right in front of him. He looked at the newspaper, 5th of May, fifth day of the fifth month. And he thought, is this some omen? Some heavenly beings were giving him some sort of good luck sign. So he looked in the horse racing. Here in Perth we have a horse racing track named after one in UK called Ascot. A-S-C-O-T. Five letters. So he looked in race number five. And he couldn't believe his eyes when he saw in race number five that afternoon, horse number five was called Five Angels. What would you do? So he thought, it's obvious that someone's trying to tell him something to get some good luck. Five angels, five pots of gold each, and then this horse called Five Angels running that afternoon, so he took the afternoon off work. He went to the bank. To keep the lucky number five, he took $5,000 out of his bank account. You only have these lucky moments once in your life at most. So he went to the racetrack, he took the fifth bookmaker in line. The kid, the lucky number five, $5,000 to win, horse number five, race number five, Five Angels. He knew the lucky number five couldn't be wrong. The lucky number five wasn't wrong. His horse came in fifth. That's the trouble. You get a prediction, but you don't really get it right. You don't understand it properly. Okay, so we do the coffin joke. Okay, can you turn the lights down, please? Can you turn the lights down? I'm serious. So this again. There was a gentleman who went to the Buddhist Society to listen to a talk. And at the end of the talk, he had to go home, walk home. He had a choice. Either go along the main road okay. That's good. I know. That's right. I can read down a bit more. Yeah, that's good. Yes. Okay, that'll do. Please stay there, Prem, because either go down the main road, which is the long way round, or take the shortcut through the cemetery. He wasn't afraid of ghosts. So he decided to go through the cemetery. And so he was walking, when he got to the halfway in the middle of the cemetery, nothing had happened, nothing to be afraid of. But then after the halfway mark, as he was walking towards the gate, he kind of heard like someone was following him. Have you ever had that feeling that, you know, you're being followed? It was only a feeling at first, but nevertheless, his pace of walking speeded up. And then he was listening more mindfully. And he was sure that something was behind him, going bump, bump, bump. And he made a big mistake. He decided to look around. And as he turned around, he almost had a heart attack. Because what was going bump, bump, bump behind him was a vertical coffin. You know the coffin shapes? And it was still mud and soil on it was falling off and cobwebs all over it. He freaked out, he started running towards the gate. And as he was running, bump, 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 even the coffin picked up speed. And he didn't live far away from the front gate of the cemetery, so he thought he was okay. He reached the front gate and he thought the coffin couldn't get out of the front gate because coffins belong in cemeteries. So he breathed a sigh of relief and started walking away from the gate of the cemetery. He looked around again and the coffin had got out of the gate, was walking along the footpath next to the road. Bump, 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 following him. And he freaked out again and he ran as fast as his legs could carry him to his house. And as he was running, bump, 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 the coffin was running after him. And worse, it was catching up. So you really catch me. So when he got to this garden gate, he didn't open his garden gate, he jumped over it and ran to the door. And as he got to the door, he turned around, the coffin had got to the gate, but the coffin couldn't jump. And it said the coffin went bang, bang against the gate, really strongly. He knew that coffin was going to break that gate to bits and then come after him. So he picked out his keys, and then he could hear bang as the coffin broke the gate and started coming along the short distance on the garden path towards him. So he picked up whatever key he could from the floor, put it in the lock. He was so lucky it was the right key. Turned the lock, opened the door, jumped inside and banged the door shut just before the coffin reached the front door of his house. He was sweating, his heart was pounding like seeing an imitator. But he was inside now. He thought he was safe. He made it home. Bang! Bang! As the coffin started to hit the front door. And in many of your houses, there's always a little glass panel in the front door. He could see the shape of the coffin on the other side of the glass trying to get in. Bang! And he could start to see the wood starting to shatter and the hinges starting to come off. He realized it was only a matter of time before that coffin would break down the door and enter his house. What to do? He thought the only other room which had a lock on it was the bathroom. So he ran up the stairs. He turned around, bang! The coffin was trying to break down the front door. Bang! And when he got to the top of the stairs, bang! And the coffin broke the front door of his house down. And the coffin just came inside. And the coffin looked to the left, looked to the right, then looked up, could see him. So he ran inside the bathroom door, locked the door, bump, 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 as the coffin started to climb the stairs. He was really scared. He couldn't see it, but he could hear it. So he tried to hide in the bathroom. Bang! As the coffin started to get to the top of the stairs and start hitting the bathroom door. He was in big trouble now. If that coffin could break down the front door of his house, the bathroom should be very easy for that coffin to break down. Bang! Bang! And the bathroom door shattered into pieces. And the coffin came in the bathroom, just so close to him, nowhere else to run, nowhere else to escape. This coffin which had followed him from the cemetery, he was facing it with nothing, no place to hide. So just instinctively, he got some medicine which was on one of the shelves and threw it at the coffin. And the glass bottle broke and all this brown smelly liquid went over the coffin, and the coffin never moved again. He threw cough mixture over the coffin. It stops the coffin. Okay. We can have the right sound now. Thank you. That's what the pharmacist says. It stops the coffin. Okay. You asked for it. Be careful what you ask again. So that's a coffin story. So have a wonderful night if you wish. And if you hear anything following you tonight, bang, bang, bang. Send it to my room. Okay. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good.